Welcome to the Union Jews Podcast. The UK's only all things union show. Carefully curated for your digital downloadable listening pleasure. Hello, 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 and welcome to the Union Jews Podcast. Still, the UK's only all things union show, carefully curated for your digital downloadable listening pleasure. I'm Simon Sapper, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this special edition of the podcast. Well, I say pleasure, but the subject matter is anything but. Sexual harassment is in the news, and that in itself is bad news. Bad news that this is a scourge that shows no sign of disappearing soon. Bad news because it is both reflective and fueling of misogyny in our society. Bad news because part of the picture is the failure of some trade unions to live their values, becoming contaminated with sexual harassment rather than a progressive bulwark against it. Guided by Andrea Oates, author of an excellent new LRD publication on sexual harassment, we drill down into questions of definitions, prevalence, legal remedies, effective union campaigns on awareness, prevention, reporting, monitoring, and of course, representation. We also get to grips with a firmly established pattern of underreporting, alleged aggressors and sexual harassment survivors being not just colleagues, but members of the same union, and the reluctance by employers to act to defend workers when perpetrators are third parties, such as customers. But sadly, union structures have not been immune from misogyny and sexual harassment, and successive devastating reports over the recent past into the GMB, the RCN, the TSSA, showed how those unions had become delinquent with awful consequences for female staff and activists. So, we're joined by Fliss Premrew of the Me To You Women campaign group, which came into being to give a voice to those denied one for so long, to talk about the steps they believe it's necessary for unions to take to drive out sexual harassment and create genuinely safe spaces for women reps and activists. The Bakers and Food Workers Union are often cited as an example of best practice in this area, so who better to hear from than their General Secretary, Sarah Woolley, on the what, where, why, and how of the union's much-admired activity in this space. It's my great pleasure to welcome Andrea Oates back to the Union Jews podcast. Andrea's a freelance writer and NUJ member and has been writing for LRD publications for, blimey, around 30 years. She also works for UK and European trade unions from time to time. Her main areas of interest are health and safety and environmental issues, but she also writes more widely about current affairs for a trade union audience. And before she worked at LRD, she was an environmental health officer and union rep in local government. I started off by asking Andrea for her assessment about how one can define sexual harassment and how prevalent it is. Andrea, perhaps the place to start is to get a common understanding about what sexual harassment is and how widespread it is.
Yeah, so I mean, just in terms of how widespread sexual harassment is, you know, there's been lots of surveys by trade union organisations and others that sort of suggest that it's, you know, really prevalent. And there was I think it was a Women in Equalities Committee did a survey a few years ago, I think in 2018. So it was a cross-party parliamentary Women in Equalities Committee inquiry, and they found that unwanted sexual comments, touching, groping and assault are seen as an everyday occurrence and part of the culture in many workplaces, you know, which is sort of quite shocking, really. And the TUC did a kind of big landmark piece of research in 2016 where they found that I think it was more than half of women had experienced sexual harassment at work. And recently, in May, a TUC poll of more than 1,000 women found that 3 in 5 women say they've experienced harassment at work, rising to almost 2 in 3 women aged 25 to 34. So in terms of kind of the definition of sexual harassment, the NASUW teaching union, they've got some online advice that says if a person's behaviour is unwanted and is of a sexual nature, then it's sexual harassment. And it doesn't matter if other colleagues in the workplace find the person's behaviour acceptable, or whether it's one-off or repeated behaviour. And they say, if it makes you feel intimidated, uncomfortable or degraded, then it's harassment.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose that there are three things that come out of that, aren't there? The first is that sexual harassment is necessarily a subjective matter, isn't it? You can't substitute your feelings for the person who has suffered sexual harassment. I suppose that's the first thing. Second thing is, sexual harassment is clearly on a spectrum, isn't it, that leads very quickly into sexual violence and therefore the misogyny that's still at large in parts of society. And I suppose the third thing is that, in common with lots of harassment-type issues, I bet there's a huge amount of underreporting.
Yeah, so just to deal with that last point, I think most of the surveys that I've looked at have time and time again, you know, women, it's mostly women that experience sexual harassment, are experiencing sexual harassment at work and they're not reporting it. So I think something like 4 out of 5 women don't report. That sort of, that groundbreaking TUC research, still just a bit of banter. In that there was more than half of women have experienced some form of sexual harassment in the workplace, but 4 out of 5 didn't report it to their employer. And I think that comes out sort of over and over again. One of the reasons is, kind of fear of reprisal and further victimisation. And that issue, I was just going to come back on where you're talking about it, sexual harassment being subjective. There's a Equality and Human Rights Commission guidance on sexual harassment and harassment at work, which is kind of official guidance, but not a statutory code, but it kind of can be used as evidence in legal proceedings. And it sort of sets out good practice and explains the law in detail. And yeah, I mean, it's not about what the perpetrator intended. It's about how the person on the receiving end, whether that comes that was sort of, unwanted or unwelcome.
We'll come back to dealing with the phenomenally widespread problem, it seems, or challenge of underreporting. But if people do report the sexual harassment, how can the law help?
I suppose the law, trade unions are kind of arguing for the law to be made stronger. And as I say, the kind of detailed guidance that the EHRC has produced is kind of not law and it's not a statutory code, it's guidance. But it does talk about, that a good anti-harassment procedure will tell workers how to make a complaint, and there should be kind of multiple reporting channels, and it should set out a range of approaches, including kind of, what the employer is going to do about it in terms of sanctions or whatever.
I'm thinking of the legal umbrella under which sexual harassment claims could sit. There would obviously be the Health and Safety at Work Act, because there is a duty of care on employers. And if this isn't a duty of care, then goodness knows what is. But there's also the provisions of the 2010 Equality Act when it comes to sexual harassment. Is there anything else that makes up a kind of this umbrella of legal protection? And how effective is it at providing coverage?
Yeah, so, I mean, the main source of legal rights to protection from sexual harassment at work is the Equality Act 2010. And that prohibits three types of sexual harassment. So that's unwanted conduct related to sex, unwelcome conduct of a sexual nature, and then less favourable treatment. So if that's where somebody's been treated less favourably because they've rejected or submitted to unwanted conduct of a sexual nature. And then also victimisation, it protects workers against victimisation. So, and that's kind of fear of victimisation is one of the biggest barriers to people reporting harassment at work. So, I mean, on top of that, so they're the kind of key provisions of the Equality Act. As you say, you've also got health and safety law. So, for example, after the booklet had been drafted, the Scottish TUC Women's Committee labelled sexual harassment at work as a form of violence and assault, and wrote to the Health and Safety Executive calling on them to regulate sexual harassment as a serious health and safety risk. And I think there's a quote in the booklet from somebody at the STUC who said, health and safety isn't just about accidents, it's also, the HSE should be taking action and enforcement action around sexual harassment, which they they don't at the moment. There's also the law relating to employment contracts, which includes an implied contractual right to work in a safe environment free from unwanted invasions of personal space and dignity. The law related to constructive dismissal, criminal laws prohibiting sexual assault, stalking or malicious communications, such as sending an unwelcome sexually explicit email or text, and then rights under the Protection of Harassment Act 1997, which have been used in an employment context. So there is lots of law, but I mean, it's clearly not working when you look at how prevalent sexual harassment is. As I say, the STUC have called for the HSE to get involved. There is a private members bill going through at the moment. So I think the government's kind of, promised to bring forward legislation around sexual harassment and more broadly around harassment. But I mean, I'm sure the obvious place for that would be the employment bill, which is kind of never materialised and gets, every year it's not in the Queen's speech. But there is a private members bill called the Worker Protection Amendment of Equality Act 2010 bill, which would introduce a new duty on employers to take all reasonable steps to prevent sexual harassment of their employees in the course of their employment. But although this has got government backing and sort of, should stand a reasonable chance of getting through the legislative process, Tory backbench peers have put forward more than 40 amendments. So there's concern around that law, not actually making it through the parliamentary process. So I think there's lots of good guidance around. And I think, if you're a kind of responsible employer, you can find really good guidance. The EHRC guidance is really good, and it sort of sets out 7 steps what are reasonable steps to avoid sexual harassment. And, that's what employers should do to avoid liability for harassment. But, there's questions over, people don't report it, the compensation's very low, the law's not strong enough, it's not, it's not enforced properly. So I think quite a long way to go.
Yeah, and of course, once people report sexual harassment, there is always the risk of victimisation of those further harassment of those individuals. So if we look at what union campaigns to tackle sexual harassment have taken place and what they look like, there must be quite a rich scene to explore there.
Yeah, so I mean, in the booklet, I think all unions are doing stuff around sexual harassment, have put out information for members and reps. And so in the booklet, we picked out examples that looked at kind of different ways to campaign. So we highlighted the Global Food Workers Unions, where they'd had a campaign around McDonald's. So they looked at right across the world at what happened, including in the UK, where the Bakers Union or Food Workers Union were involved in that campaign. And they sort of used some voluntary guidance around multinational enterprises, and they kind of used the OEC guidelines to kind of take a case, to sort of document what had been going on in McDonald's. And earlier this year in the UK, the company signed a legally binding, what's called a Section 23 agreement with the EHRC under the Equality Act 2006. Where it's an agreement where organisations commit not to breach equality law, and it's usually in an area where there have been previous concerns, and the regulator can initiate court action to enforce it if necessary. Mm. And so that sort of highlighted an example of a kind of international campaign that included a UK union.
It's important to point out, I think, that these are allegations against McDonald's rather than proven non-compliance, just to make that clear. But the IUF Global Food Workers Confederation did file an unprecedented complaint alleging systematic sexual harassment against the company, and this is spelt out in the LRD booklet itself. Are there examples from other unions that you can point to, Andrea?
We highlighted the NEU's It's Not Okay campaign, taking a whole school approach. They previously carried out some research that found that sexism and sexual harassment in schools has been normalised and is really reported. And they put together this toolkit to sort of, you know, how their reps could make sure there's a whole school approach to preventing sexism and sexual harassment. And that had a kind of a set of five themes, which looked at leadership, staff, students, curriculum and community, and five threads. So infrastructure, inclusion, interpersonal, internal and imagery. And it was kind of about, you know, how to get everybody, sending a clear message across the school that everyone in the school community can play a role in preventing sexism and sexual harassment.
And what has happened in schools and what the NEU campaign makes me very mindful of, Andrea, is that we're talking here about cultural change, aren't we?
Yeah.
It's not just a policy shift. It's not just, important as it is, having a reporting mechanism. It is a complete culture change that's necessary. And I wonder how trade union negotiators have approached that challenge, trying to, first of all, engaging with the employers and then trying to move the culture in a progressive anti-harassment direction.
Yeah, so I mean, I think TUC and Unison, I think, are two organisations that have talked about the risk factor for sexual harassment being related to an institutional cultural climate that, and specifically a perceived tolerance for sexual harassment. Unison's guidance talks about a zero tolerance approach to sexual harassment must go beyond a mere statement. It must be actively promoted by the employers at all levels of the organisation and reinforced through training. Yeah, so it's not just a policy that sits on a shelf. It's something that's kind of, it's reinforced over and over again, what the kind of expectations that the employer has around behaviour, and that starts right from induction, but you have training that's refreshed, and it's a kind of ongoing thing to repeatedly, you know, you're just messaging all the time about what, you know, what is acceptable and what's not acceptable behaviour and what zero tolerance that actually means. So, yeah, I suppose like anything, you know, there's lots of quotes, aren't there, about policies, you know, it's no good if it's sitting gathering dust on the shelf. It's got to really be, you know, actively promoted, I suppose, that you're kind of sending a clear message to everyone that it's kind of, you know, what's unacceptable behaviour, but also, you know, if you report sexual harassment, that the employer is going to do something about it. You know, you're not going to be victimised. It will be taken seriously. It will be acted upon, and there will be a fair investigation. Because the other side of it is that, you know, for unions, they're often going to be representing the perpetrator as well as the person at the receiving end of sexual harassment.
So, Andrea, what does a good complaints policy when it comes to sexual harassment look like? Obviously, the issue must be taken seriously. There must be a prompt and reassuring response by the people receiving the complaint. The survivor's wishes must be respected. The survivor kind of needs to take ownership of the process, really, as far as is possible. You clearly can't come to conclusions without proper investigation. But what other things feature in a good anti-sexual harassment complaints policy?
Yeah, so just going through some of the guidance. So the EHRC, their guidance on sexual harassment and harassment at work says that a good harassment procedure will tell workers how to make a complaint and not be too restricted. It should define multiple reporting channels and set out a range of approaches for dealing with harassment, ranging from informal solutions to formal disciplinary processes. And it should provide contact details for and information about support and advice services provided sort of within the workplace and beyond. So I think some of the union advice around this, so the NASUWT sort of makes the point that complaints should be raised and dealt with promptly, and there shouldn't be unreasonable delay of meetings, decisions or confirmation of those decisions, because I think it's kind of, you know, it's stressful for everybody, isn't it, if things kind of don't get responded to in a timely way. I suppose one of the things that LRD found in its research was kind of around redeployment. So sometimes the research found that it's the alleged perpetrator and complainant work in the same team, and it may be necessary to temporarily deploy or even suspend a perpetrator. But LRD found that sometimes it's the complainant that's moved from their place of work and put in other departments where they can end up feeling sort of isolated. So I think that's quite important, that it's not, you know, the person on the receiving end that then kind of gets moved because it's like they're seen as a problem to some extent.
I suppose many people listening to this podcast, if the union reps will, have been in the invidious position, and I know I certainly was on a couple of occasions, of where you have a survivor from sexual harassment and the alleged perpetrator both being members not just of the same union, but the same branch, clearly not a sustainable setup. Have you, Andrea, in your research found examples of best practice or devices that unions have come up with to avoid that situation arising or to deal with it when it does?
I'm not sure about examples of where they resolve that, but I think the advice is that unions should have a clear policy in place to deal with that. And sometimes that is where, you know, perhaps a regional officer will get involved rather than, you know, two reps in the same workplace, you know, representing different members.
Yeah, I mean, the as you say, the obvious solution is to have a clear policy about escalation routes up from the point of the incident to make sure that there is no conflict generated by one rep having to represent two people on either side of an argument.
Yeah. So you wouldn't have the same. Yeah. So you'd have separate reps, and in some cases, regional officer would get involved. And I think probably key thing that came out of just looking at the, you know, union and other guidance around that is just in terms of it, because you know, it's a serious allegation, just making sure that it's a fair process. One of the points is about, you know, the investigator should always keep an open mind and not just for evidence pointing to guilt, but also innocence. And, you know, because of the career-threatening nature of formal allegations of sexual harassment, the standard of investigation should be very high. So I think, you know, and reps being involved in making sure that, you know, there's kind of due process and making sure it's fair process, you know, that the person who's the allegations have been made against, you know, goes through a fair process, but is kind of supported. And, you know, in some situations, reps will have a role in kind of, you know, getting them to change their behaviour, and it, I suppose, highlighting unacceptable behaviour and the, you know, the need for change, making sure that people recognise why that behaviour is not acceptable.
Indeed, and sometimes, I mean, I know from personal experience, it can sometimes be very difficult to put a mirror in front of someone and say, look, this is you and this is not okay, what's happening. And if, uncomfortable as it is, of course, trade unions are part of society. And with sexual harassment being so widespread in society and the misogyny that's part of also being unfortunately well entrenched, I suppose it's unavoidable that trade unions as organisations are at risk of being contaminated or affected by those sorts of attitudes. And of course, we've had a series of very worrying reports into trade union culture at the RCN, at the GMB, at the TSSA. What have you found that unions are doing to respond to the challenges posed by the Monaghan report, the Carr report, and so on?
I think people have been quite shocked at the Monaghan report, and, you know, what's going on at the GMB, and then the Carr report at the RCN, and then most recently the TSSA report. So I think it's prompted, I mean, you know, TUC had been doing work in this area already, but they, in 2021, which I think was after the Monaghan report, but before the Carr, the RCN and TSSA reports, the TUC established an executive committee working group to provide advice, resources, training and support on what needs to be done to prevent sexual harassment in all workplaces, starting with unions as employers. They produce some really good stuff, the TUC's sort of toolkit, which includes a sort of template called Climate Survey to anonymously gather experiences of sexual harassment, a template risk assessment, an example workplace policy, and an implementation framework. And I think that's really good, the stuff that they've produced. Those reports have been quite shocking, but also a wake-up call for, you know, other unions. And so Sarah's a general secretary at the Bakers Union, and so she's been kind of been able to, I suppose, be really hands-on and respond to stuff.
Well, you mentioned Sarah there, Sarah Woolley, general secretary of the Bakers Food and Allied Workers Union. And I think what you say and what she's done is an excellent example of why leadership, real leadership, is important in this area, because you need to have a clear statement of what the policy position is, and then the ability to control resources and funnel resources of the union to areas where there's a problem. Someone says there's a problem in my workplace, in my branch, and can know that resources will be available to deal with that problem. And that, you know, real leadership is not just the policy. It's not just a sense of morality or ethics and so on. It's actually having the practical skills and the ability to deliver.
I think that's true at ASLEP as well, and they're doing some good stuff there, which is sort of led by their lay members, you know, supported by their officials. And, you know, one of the things that they've kind of brought in rules around behaviour at conferences, they've brought in rights of women organisations to do training. I suppose the other thing I think about it is that there's been quite a lot of transparency. You know, the GMB and TSSA have both put those, you know, those whole reports on their website and then kind of sort of reported regularly on what they're doing to address the points that were made. So I think that's useful for other unions to see how they've, it's not just about what they're doing as that union, but also it's kind of lessons learned for the whole union movement. I thought there was a good quote from the MeToo trade union specific reference to the wider MeToo social movement, this campaign group. I think they make this really important point, you know, that they've said unions are fighting, you know, that we need to make sure that unions are fighting fit at this critical period of heightened industrial struggle rather than undermined by internal power politics, misogyny, harassment, sexual violence, racism, widespread structural inequality and the silencing of victims and survivors. So I think there's been kind of a bit of a sense of, you know, the women that have come forward, there's been sort of extra pressure on them because it is the trade union movement that obviously they're, you know, very committed to. But I think they make the point that actually, you know, this is about making the trade union movement stronger.
My thanks to Andrea for that comprehensive roundup of a complex and for some controversial subject. The LRD publication, Trade Unionist Guide to Sexual Harassment, really is an excellent piece of work. And if your union at branch or national level is affiliated to the LRD, you'll probably be able to get your hands on a hard or digital copy reasonably easily and reasonably cheaply. Alternatively, you can visit lrd.org.uk. Now, towards the end of our discussion, Andrea mentioned the MeToo Women Trade Union Group. This is a campaigning group to give a voice to women trade union reps and activists, many of whom are survivors of sexual harassment. To explain how the group was created and what its objectives are, I sat down with Fliss Premru. Some people have said that groups like MeToo are simply engaging in washing the union movement's dirty linen in public to no good effect. I think you'll find that Fliss deals very robustly and directly with that, as does our final guest in this episode, who'll follow on from Fliss, which is Sarah Woolley, General Secretary of the Bakers Food and Allied Workers Union.
What is MeToo and why did it come into being?
Yeah, thanks very much for speaking to me today. I am part of a campaign that's been going for about a year called MeToo, which is a growing campaign for women across the movement to deal with the very real and present problem of bullying, harassment and sexism in our movement, and to kind of really fight for proper transformative change and real equality. We've seen the number of reports over the years, the Monaghan report, the GMB, the RCN report, the Bruce Cohen report into the RCN, and more recently TSSA. And I think before I get to talking a little bit more about MeToo, I need to return to TSSA, which is the latest report. I'm actually a TSSA member myself. I'm part of the women's group, Women in Focus, and we were really shocked to find out the extent of the problem that we had in the TSSA, meeting an organiser who had been bullied and harassed out of work, and another sister, that's Maggie Hayes, and another sister, Claire Laycock, who actually broke the news, did a test, very brave testimony with Real News to say what had happened to her. Before this all came about, we'd realised that was a problem. We'd started to talk to other sisters in other unions and kind of have a few informal meetings, realised it was a really great problem, and that what the whole union movement was missing the organisation and talents and potential activism coming from real equality, spending money on non-disclosure agreements, bullying women out from head offices, possibly never to work again in the movement. That's one aspect of it. Also, there's bullying and harassment throughout the union. So it's also a problem for maybe branches and reps in some areas too. And it's how do we encourage women to come forward and how do we change that? The women's group in TSSA had quite a while before that had to write to the TUC because we had found an impasse when we were asking for change in our union. We'd written quite a while before to the general secretary in the EC to say, you know, we see what's going on with the movement. Can we have our own investigation? What are we going to do ourselves? Let's make sure we're okay. And that was before we realised kind of quite the extent of the problem. And the TEC kind of wrote back, but said it talked about training and that all their affiliates should be obviously doing best practice. But it didn't feel that it was a place, or they said they had no power for us to escalate a complaint. So one of our questions is, where do you go when you've got a problem within your union, and we don't appear to have at the moment a high body, somebody to adjudicate and somebody to help? So that was one of the questions that we were asking, and it's a question that we do ask in MeToU. We started to meet about April of last year, April 2022, and we had a lot of sisters coming in sometimes anonymously. You know, it's very difficult. A lot of women feel if they speak out, they will never get another job in the trade union, for example, if they work for union. And of course, it most notably, the irony of our own trade union movement is meant to absolutely be about equality and change and fighting for the world that we need, not the one that we have now. The MeToU movement was growing. We were having regular meetings. We've now got about 150 sisters signed up. And we were trying to make sure we had a presence at various places, whether it was on the steps of the TUC or at Toll Pedal Festival, or indeed at the trade union conference, where we did hold, we had a fringe meeting at the TUC conference in September, as well as getting to publicly speak about what was going on.
What do unions have to do to ensure that the culture change that's necessary actually has a reasonable chance of taking root?
Okay, well, I can say what we're demanding in and asking for in TSSA is for transformative change. And we've just had a recent conference, which was in stark contrast to our conference last year, and where there were very powerful testimonies. There were tributes to staff who'd been bullied out, and there were people who were upset about their own bullying and harassment in various places in the union. And what we're asking for is that women and survivors are centred in the change. It's not just that we have business as usual with different people, because that's almost the bad apple scenario that, you know, maybe the police will say it's a few bad apples, and actually what we do need is structural change. So we can't just fill those structures with different people. I think we need to look at our hierarchies. I think we've got quite hierarchical trade unions. There's very big pay differentials in some unions, and there's a lot of kinds of assumptions about succession and so on. So I think we need to really review our democratic structures. And part of the problem is that we slightly ape corporations in some way. And then there's the relationship also with the Labour Party too, because the problem is kind of in the trade union and labour movement. So at the conference, we demanded that survivors and women and the women's group is brought into the room, that we have meaningful conversations, feed into not only an action plan, but also to the monitoring of that action plan to see what has actually been done and where we go, or where there are appointments, or where there is a big change, that we are a part of that. And if we are excluded, and part of the problem is that there have been a lot of silos, for example, in TSSA, and I think there are in some other unions too, keeping staff from reps, from EC, from the total power at the top. And actually, that all needs to break down and be very, very transparent. So it's about turning it around to be transparent, to have adequate whistleblowing, to have a place to go, which is beyond your union, to stop the use of NDAs apart from, well, I don't know, there is a very specific reason within a trade union. In some businesses, they might use it for trade secrets or something, but there is not, that doesn't seem that when a member of staff leaves, and especially with bullying, that we can use those sanctions. It's a form of silencing. And that we are all linked up, and there are democratic routes to elections, that we have more elected posts. We've had only an elected general secretary, but even that has been an assumption of who would take part and who would be kind of in that job and who might replace them. And it's very important that that is an open competition, which is fully understood by branches and reps and self-organising groups as well. That self-organising groups need to take a much bigger place as well, because it's about equality, and it's about all equalities, as well as the harassment. You've obviously got problems elsewhere with racism, homophobia, ableism, and so on. So I think we really need to make a change with this.
And as you look across the trade union and labour movement as a whole, based on your own experience and those of the sisters involved in MeToU, are there examples of good practice or best practice that you can point to as an exemplar for other unions?
So I think, and MeToU says, that really every union and the TUC should be taking on an inquiry themselves, doing a survey and a proper inquiry to see what's needed. And that's really the only way that we will move forward, and we can move forward together. That this change is not only needed, but it's going to make us stronger, and it'll make us fit to fight for the future that we need, especially with the cost of living and the climate crisis.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Liz. That was an important contribution to the debate. And I think anyone who's listening to that can't say that they don't know or unaware of some of the challenges that our sisters are facing in various places across the movement. Not everywhere, of course, perhaps not even in most places, but if it's happening at all, it's happening too much. And of course, there are steps we can all take to stop it happening, or even to prevent it starting. And that leads us very neatly to Sarah Woolley, General Secretary of the Bakers and Food Workers Union, the BFAWU. I think it's fair to say that Sarah has had something of a meteoric rise in trade union terms, working at Greggs in 2016 to being elected as General Secretary, the union's first female General Secretary, around 4 years later. And she and the Baker and Food Workers Union as a whole are frequently pointed to as an example of best practice in the UK labour movement when it comes to sexual harassment. Now, Sarah also sits on the executive committee of the General Federation of Trade Unions and is generally extremely busy and has just had her own union's annual conference. I was particularly grateful to Sarah for taking time to have a chat with me about why the union has adopted the stance and the policies it has, and why this is just such an important issue for the trade union movement in the UK and beyond.
What I was particularly keen to discuss with you, Sarah, was the approach that the union has taken, and that you as the General Secretary have taken, towards sexual harassment, which I think is distinctive in many regards. In particular, the dedicated email address, which goes directly to you, and which enables you to have visibility of the issue and direct resources as appropriate to address the issue. Is that something that was sort of in your mind to do before you became General Secretary, or was it something that you felt was necessary once you'd been in the job a while?
It was one of the first things that I suggested to our EC that we did. Obviously, I became GS after everything that kicked off in GMB, and wanted from day one to try and have an avenue that women predominantly, but people could get in touch with to say that there was an issue, so that they'd have confidence that it would be dealt with, and I'd have confidence that it'd be dealt with, rather than it be, and I'm not saying it necessarily has been in our union, but rather than it be kind of brushed to one side and passed from pillar to post, our general complaints procedure is quite complicated and drags things out, and it felt wrong that something that could be as traumatic as sexual harassment or worse would be drawn out process for the survivor.
Right. And did you find that you were getting a lot of emails?
No, I mean, thankfully, touch wood, the only emails I get in that inbox at the minute are spam. which is good. We ran kind of a survey a couple of years ago using the TUC model, kind of comprehensive survey that they put together around sexual harassment. And to be fair, we didn't get anything back that was a cause of concern about internal structures or internal people. There was a lot around the employers that our members worked for, yes, and their lack of dealing with things, but not internally in the union, which is, you know, great. We're going to keep working and rerun it to make sure that it wasn't just a fluke. But I think that alongside the lack of emails suggests that we've not necessarily got a massive issue. It's not that we've not got any issues. We've still got a lot of work to do. There's still a lot of sexism and misogyny in our union, but thankfully no reports of harassment and assault.
Right. Okay. So in terms of the employers then, and especially given that you've got significant numbers of members who are public facing, what's the approach been to try and get those employers to engage with the union to come up with successful policies to change the culture in many of these workplaces?
So we had not everybody put where they worked, which kind of makes things difficult. We've always had conversations where we've got national agreements, such as with Greggs and things like that, and they've got quite good policies in place. But where we'd got responses to that survey that identified a specific site, so there was one in Northern Ireland, for argument's sake, and they named the company. We only look after one site within that company over in Northern Ireland. So I gave the quote to the regional officer that has conversations and deals with that site, and she took it in and said, look, we've run this survey, this is what has been said, what are we going to do about it? And they sat down and looked at policies and looked at how they can change the culture. So as much as we didn't have a massive response, which was also an issue, but a massive response to the survey, because it's quite comprehensive, just that one response has changed that workplace, which is, you know, exactly what we wanted to do.
Absolutely. I suppose that the aim is to get to a position where these bad behaviours are so marginalised and rare that everyone gets that this is wrong and it shouldn't happen. I mean, it sounds as if the employer in that case in Northern Ireland was almost as shocked by what came out of the survey as you and your colleagues. Have you had situations where it's the other way around, where the employer just says, we don't care, or it's not true?
Well, yeah, I mean, you've only got to see what's been in the news in the last few months around McDonald's and the EHRC stuff that they've done.
That was in my mind, yes.
So, they are so kind of like, no, we've not got an issue. We've dealt with it. There's no issues. But they've always been like that. It's very much like, let's just deny at all costs. But there is massive issues in that workplace. You know, anywhere that's got 0 hours contracts for a start, there is the risk, shall we say, of harassment, bullying, sexual harassment, because the power's in the hands of the manager.
Indeed, but I presume you'd agree that it ultimately that's not sustainable.
No, absolutely not.
You can't run a business if your people aren't with you. So.
Exactly, or they're traumatised by what's happened to them.
Yeah. Well, is there an issue about third party sexual harassment by third parties, by customers in some of these areas where your members are working? And if so, what's been the response of the employer to that, and what's been the assistance or the support that the union's drawn up to deal with members who find themselves in that position?
Do you know, I smiled when you said that, and I wasn't smiling because it was funny. I was smiling because I was remembering my own experiences, obviously when I worked for Greggs, and some of the stuff that people come out with, you know, whether that's hanging around outside the shop when it closes because, you know, yeah, well, I want to take you for a drink, or the complete other end of it, hanging around outside the shop after it closes because you've given me the wrong change and I'm adamant you've given me the wrong change and I need to deal with it. He's just, I've had pizzas thrown at me, been spat at, sworn at, threatened, all sorts of stuff whilst working behind a counter, because it's almost like people think that you're kind of a second-class citizen because you're behind that counter serving them. And I don't think whatever policies and procedures are in place, that's never going to stop because an employer is never going to stop an individual's behaviour either. But I think from when I was in a Greg shop, which is now, I came out of the shop in 2016, we're now in 2023, to where we are now in terms of CCTV, you know, security measures, a standard, the higher gates, the higher counters. I mean, the CCTV is phenomenal these days. You know, you can identify tattoos and everything. The panic buttons and the alarms that are in place as standard, that is so much more advanced now than it was 5-10 years ago. Is that everywhere? No, I don't think it is. And I think, you know, members that work in Wetherspoons and other kind of pubs and public houses and that kind of thing, they have got to go through that so much more. They're not just behind a counter. They are clearing tables. They are directly deal with people that are intoxicated because that's the general nature of their workplace. Is there enough in place to support them? No, not at all. Not at all. And that's another company, Wetherspoons, where as a union, we've tried to say you need to be better, but deny. There's not a problem. Our employees aren't telling us there's an issue. Well, they're not telling you there's an issue because they're scared of losing the job if they do. That doesn't mean to say there isn't an issue. That just means to say that you're running a business through fear, which again isn't sustainable. Yeah, I mean,
underreporting of sexual harassment is, I think, has been a well established feature of the landscape, and it takes quite some amount of change and courage to shift that in the right direction. At successive conferences of the Bakers Food and Allied Workers Union, policies have been adopted to strengthen the union's stance on sexual harassment and to achieve that sort of cultural change that gets you to a place where people, union members particularly, just intuitively understand what's right and wrong on this. Has there been any resistance to that? Have there been any things during that journey that have surprised you? And what's the next step in it?
Yes, there has been things that have surprised me and some people that have pushed back on things that we've tried to put in place to make sure everybody is safer have surprised me as well. They weren't necessarily the people that I thought would push back. But we put in place last year a code of conduct for all reps that outlined how they should be a safe place for members to go to and they shouldn't be making sexist comments online, and that they are kind of the ambassadors of the trade union at all times. And we were accused by some of becoming like the employers that we deal with. And we're saying, but this is to protect you. It's to protect the union. It's to ensure that our members know that the union's a safe space for them to come to. So, yeah, and then, you know, International Women's Day, you see members and activists and reps posting things that, you know, just amount to sexism and misogyny on social media, and it is disappointing. And I know we're not the only union that's got that, you know, but I think the whole movement's got a lot of work to do around that. And then this year we had, we had a motion at conference. I'll read it to you. I've just been talking about it this morning around Andrew Tate and removing his influence. So the motion said, it was the last one, because I had the privilege of responding. Since the arrest of Andrew Tate, we as a union should call upon all unions to campaign against the propagandising of gross misogyny online. And that sparked an interesting debate. I was expecting people to go, yeah, we should be doing more, and, you know, we should be clamping down on this. And a couple of people got up and one said, well, I'm not actually sure it's that bad what he's saying. Shocked me. And then another one got up and said, I don't think this should be a motion that we're debating at our conference. There are more important motions to be talking about and debating and having policy on than misogyny or Andrew Tate that, you know, that's been arrested abroad. And I was sat there and I'd written my speech out and I was thinking, I could feel my heckles rising and thought, no, calm down, calm down. So when I got up and spoke, I identified what misogyny meant. You know, spoke about the fact that nearly half of our members are women. So that means the majority of them will have experienced misogyny in their lifetime. You know, the damage that Andrew Tate's doing by influencing young men to almost tell women that they should be grateful young men are talking to them. And then just outlined how to stop sexism and that we've got to have our own house in order, and challenged everybody to challenge it, call it out, ask why people find their sexist comments funny, and shut down those conversations and support others that are challenging it as well. And I didn't go on a rant about the individual that had said, but I stopped myself from doing that, but kind of finished by saying, you know, sexist comments are not welcome in our trade union. And kind of laid out the land then for being able to challenge it going forwards, because I don't think we've really, as much as we've had the motions that we've had over the last few years and the different things that we've put in place, we've not really drawn that line in the sand like we have done with racism. You know, we've been quite clear, we will not accept racists in our union, and we will call it out, and we will challenge people that put racist things on social media, but we've not done that with sexism. So we've kind of drawn that line in the sand now. So the next one will be challenging people.
What would you say are the characteristics of an effective policy on sexual harassment?
The characteristics of an effective policy of sexual harassment are no tolerance. No tolerance. You know, somebody making a joke about how women are doing this or women are... No, don't joke about things. We're supposed to be professionals. No use of non-disclosure agreements. It cannot be right that survivors are silenced or pushed out of the trade union movement, because it's easier to do that than deal with the perpetrator. Believe people. Believe those that are coming forward and saying there's an issue. Even if you've known the person for 35 years and wouldn't think that they were ever capable of doing something like that, there is a reason that sister's coming forward to say this has happened to me. Believe them. And ensure that we need to ensure that there's a independent form of investigation. You know, if a general secretary is the perpetrator, there is absolutely no way in that trade union that there's going to be a full, fair and transparent process. There needs to be an independent investigation process. And the TUC potentially is the body to support that.
Right. And is transparency a key ingredient in this, do you think?
Absolutely. Transparency, and that's one of the calls from me to you, is how much are trade unions spending of membership's money on non-disclosure agreements and tribunals and covering up sexual harassment? You know, is that the best use of trade union members' money? Absolutely not.
What do you think the particular value is of organisations like Me to You and the network of women activists and reps in achieving the cultural change that's necessary?
I think in a movement where it's still very male-orientated in senior leadership positions, we've got to have a grassroots-led, as grassroots as it can be, because a lot of us are kind of lay activists / officials, a grassroots-led way of challenging behaviours and the structures and the culture of the movement. So the TUC are doing their own things, you know, training, highlighting it, you know, calling out and supporting trade unions in their transition to be less, will change the culture. But Me to You is about giving survivors a voice, an opinion, the opportunity to drive things or drive the action in a direction that they need and want, not one that's, you know, protect the movement at all costs. And that ruffles feathers at times, but so it should. You know, we should have our house in order, and we shouldn't be ashamed of saying, you know, I've said this a few times, people say, well, we shouldn't be washing our dirty linen in public because the right wing might attack us. Well, they're attacking us anyway. And we should be in a position where there is nothing to attack. And whilst ever there are people abusing their positions within our movement, then there is an absolute need for organisations like MeToo, because with all the best will in the world, the bureaucracy of the TUC, the bureaucracy of the senior, and you know, I'm part of that now, of the senior leaders in the trade union movement, there's too many that want to protect their own interests at all costs, and we've got to change that. And MeToo is the body that will change that.
My thanks to Andrea, to Fliss, and to Sarah, but what on earth are we to make of all this? The union movement's not alone in having a sexual harassment challenge. Just look at organisations from the CBI to the England Cricket Board. But of all people, we should be better. We have no excuse. We know the damage that is done to individuals. We know the toxic, corrosive effect sexual harassment has on society. We proclaim our commitment to inclusivity and diversity, and we've let ourselves down badly. As a wake-up call, it could hardly come any louder. So it's good, it really is good to see a prompt and wide-ranging response to the TUC's action plan, with unions developing new plans to go alongside preventative work already being undertaken. We can't go back to how some of us were, and we can't face the battles we need to fight when we are willfully distracting ourselves with bad behaviours and the consequences of them. Personally, I just don't get it. I can't get inside the head of someone who simultaneously claims to be a good trade unionist whilst harassing or condoning the harassment of our sisters. How bad must it be, or must it have been, for some of our sisters to go public on this? Pretty bad is the inevitable answer. This podcast hasn't been an easy listen, I know, but we can't talk about and champion the huge amount of good stuff we do without acknowledging and taking care of our own imperfections. And in doing that, I believe we make ourselves stronger. Well, we're nearly out of time for this special episode of the podcast. Thanks once again to our contributors, and thank you for taking the time and trouble to spend the last 40 minutes or so in our company. We've enjoyed having you along. You can find background, links, and signposting to a whole range of issues that our speakers discussed on the companion blog to this episode. If you go to makes-you-think.com, you go to the makes-you-think.com website, under the blogs tab there, you'll find the companion blog right at the top of the pile. Please do join the conversation. If there's anything you've heard today that you've got a view on, that you want to debate, things you think we should have included, things you think we shouldn't have included, you can email the show at unionnews@makes-you-think.com. We'd like to hear exactly what you think. When it comes to this episode, please share it as widely as you can. Also, if you'd like to leave us a review on the podcast platform of your choice, we'd be delighted. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jews Union. Union Jews is part of the Labour Radio Podcast Network, a portal through which you can access over 100 Labour-related radio shows and podcasts. It's at labourradionetwork.org. I hope you've enjoyed what you've heard, even if some of it has been rather challenging, and will join us for future editions of Union Jews, and check out our sister show, Union Days, wherever you get your podcasts from. Until then, this is me, Simon Sapper, saying thanks for listening, and bye for now.